This is Brandon Kelly, the host of Blue Wire's new podcast, Golden Goal.
Messi takes everybody on. Messi has got it!
From Lionel Messi to Marta to Pele, our show takes a deep dive into soccer superstars.
2-0, and he's... What a World Cup for Megan Rapinoe!
From Zlatan Ibrahimovic's brash confidence with the play to back it up, to Megan Rapinoe's heroic outspokenness and World Cup flair. Each episode examines a personality of the world's game. We'll dig into Maradona's Hand of God performance and subsequent downfall, the teenage trio at Dortmund that signaled the next generation of superstars, and that infamous headbutt that slung Zinedine Zidane from glory. Golden Goal, soccer stars and the moments that made them. Premiering this summer on Blue Wire.
Blue Wire.
Iguodala to Curry, back to Iguodala, up for the layup, oh, blocked by James! It's over, Cleveland is a city of champions once again!
The Cleveland Cavaliers select Colin Sexton, Darius Garland.
Here comes Sexton, some rhythm,
and he got it, young boy! Continues to wear them out.
Do you know what the Cavs fans are calling the Darius Garland, Colin Sexton backcourt?
What?
Sexland.
Oh, that's good.
Welcome to the Chase Down Podcast, part of the Blue Wire Network. I'm your host, Justin Rowan. With me today is my fumbling co-host, Carter Rodriguez. Carter, how you doing, buddy?
I'm doing okay. That was a rough start. I didn't exactly tech this one out. Which you typically should do when you move to a new platform. And you know what? We paid the price. We paid the piper. And, interestingly enough, I didn't even have a setting wrong. I just had you guys muted.
Well, you know what? I don't want to have our guests muted today, Carter, because I'm very excited to have both of them on. You guys, I am feeling so appreciative. We got Seth Partnow from The Athletic here. How are you doing today, Seth?
Doing all right. Happy to be here.
And we also have friend of the pod, Dave Dufour. Seth, you're a friend of the pod, too. I should have thrown, should have directed that in your direction as well. But
we deal with this every week. Because I always say, I have to introduce Mo and Seth.
Right.
And I always start with Mo for some reason. I don't know why. It's just
habit.
No particular reason. And I say, my good buddy, Mo. And then, my other good buddy, Seth. And
then this guy.
Yeah. And then this asshole.
Poor Seth. Well, catching the back burner, catching strays.
No, don't worry. Dave's got some coming still.
I've got Hamilton today.
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah. Dear. Justin's pretty miserable. He sent this. Justin, just for peel back the curtain a little bit. We don't exactly do a ton of prep on this show, but Justin sent me a really nice rundown, and I was like, I can't wait to ruin it by arguing about Hamilton with Dave.
Well, now, we're going to be in the Zoom where it happens. So.
Oh my God. So Seth, are you a fan?
Yes.
So you're trying to convince Dave to give it a shot.
Yeah, just give it a shot.
I'm going to. Seth has got. He has convinced me to at least watch it.
Because my favorite thing about it was Amin watching it the other day and tweeting out, "Wait, do they sing all the lines?"
I love the idea that is like, ugh, no thanks.
Well, it's a very inefficient way to get a story across.
It is. It'd be a nightmare with this podcast.
I love the idea of you basically just said Shakespeare, inefficient.
Yeah. I mean, listen.
This weirdo wrote in verse.
He's a volume shooter. He's a volume shooter, that Shakespeare.
I love musicals, and I have been to a lot of them in a lot of different places. Hamilton just doesn't seem like it's going to be my kind of thing. I am going to check it out. I promise Seth I will do it. As a matter of fact, maybe we'll do like a watch party or something like that, and I'll tweet through it.
That would be a nerd. That would be a nerder. I mean,
you're gonna quality. Have to tweet through it.
Yeah,
that's definitely tweet through it. But here's what I will say. I will give it a fair shake. If I like it, I will admit it. I'm not one of these people that I can pre-hate something and then have my mind changed. Mm-hmm. I'm totally fine with it, admitting that I was wrong about it if I am wrong. But man, if I'm right, Seth is never going to hear the end of it.
Well, funny enough, that's actually what we're trying to do with the Cavs as well. We're trying to convince
people. He doesn't want to talk about this anymore.
Yeah.
You just have to tweet through it.
We're trying to convince people that something that looks very bad right now won't always be bad. So that's what we're here for.
I do not accept the analogy.
The Cleveland Cavaliers are the Hamilton of NBA teams. We are very appreciative of you two, though. You guys did your Outlook series along with Danny LaRue. Sam Vecenie also contributed on the Cavs. And giving us content and things to talk about in the middle of what will likely be the longest offseason of my Cavs fandom, hopefully, fingers crossed. It's very, very, very damn appreciative. But before we get into the Cavs, I just want to get both of your thoughts. Seth, we'll start with you on just kind of how you feel about the NBA season potentially restarting here without the delete eight.
I think that the thing that gets overlooked a lot, I think Adam Silver was right when he said basically, like, on some level, every business in America that does not operate in a distanced fashion is going through how do we continue as a business through this, because, you know, the proper response was not instituted to this. And so here we are. So our choices are sit at home for 2 years or figure something that is suboptimal out, but best we can do under the circumstances. And, you know, Dave and I have talked to epidemiologists a lot. We've had a couple on our show a few times.
Who hasn't?
Exactly. Shouts to Zach Binney. But
right. Superstar.
Yeah, but the league seems to be doing everything that can practically done to have this come off in as safe a way as possible. And, you know, the you can't look past the fact that the background risk is not zero. So it's not like play games, get sick, don't play games, you're perfectly safe. I think just by virtue of give or take 7% of players who've been tested have tested positive coming back into facilities.
Yeah, and that's the only ones that are actively sick right now, right?
That's not even
with the antibody testing.
And so it's, you know, the people are getting sick from this, and basketball players are people. Ergo, so it's balancing. Is there additional risk, and is the business proposition? Because I don't think there's anything dirty about saying it's a business. It's professional basketball.
Some people think it's dirty.
Okay, well,
I just wish they wouldn't.
Yeah, right. over here in the real world, So I think that sums up my feelings on that.
What about you, Dave?
I mean, the number one thing is anybody who says, hey, this seems like a bad idea is right. I mean, like, let's just be honest. But leaving your house in general is a bad idea. I still am of the opinion, looking at the NBA plan, talking to Zach Binney, who is an epidemiologist. This isn't me just saying, you know, hey, Seth, let's talk this out. No, we're like, we literally have talked to people who this is their job. They say the NBA plan's solid. Zach Binney said on our podcast that there's a good chance these guys are safer in that bubble than they are at home. Right. Now, granted, everybody would be safer at their house, doors, you know, shut, staying away from other people and all these things, but it's just not realistic. We're seeing that from all the positive tests in the lead up to people going to Orlando, which, by the way, is a feature, not a bug. Like, they knew positive test rates were going to be incredibly high early. They knew that. I mean, we all saw the video of Trae Young playing pickup in Oklahoma in a packed gym.
Yeah.
We've all seen all of this stuff on social media. So we know that a lot of these players have been out doing stuff. This was built in. Now, the goal is you want to catch these all before you get to Orlando. I mean, as we're seeing with MLS, like, they're dealing with some issues. I think they've got some testing problems, though. It certainly seems like it. The NBA, I mean, I just think they're doing everything they can to try to keep everyone safe. I don't know what more we can ask. Everyone who's involved is an adult. They were giving people the option to opt out, to stay home without repercussions.
Right.
I just don't know what else they're supposed to do, because at the end of the day, I do think, like, they are doing it privately. They're not doing anything. You know, it's not like they're going to Cowboy Stadium and they're forcing 100,000 people to come into the stadium and watch them. I mean, you know, like, there's a lot of people just talking like this, like the NBA is going to create some public health crisis, when the truth is the NBA going to a place that's a, you know, going to experience a public health crisis is a way bigger problem for the NBA than what the NBA is actually doing, if that makes sense.
Yeah,
if the NBA does have a problem, where they're doing it is a bigger problem than what they're doing.
Yeah, I just think, like, ultimately, like, it almost feels like people kind of forget that there's a union on the other side, too, that is agreeing right to these terms. Like, no one's being press-ganged into this. I mean, I guess, you know, if you wanted to play, like, the ultimate devil's advocate here, you kind of make the argument, like, hey, you know, these are billionaire owners. They could make their players whole without forcing them to play. And, you know, there's a case to be made. I think it's a bit of a stretch given how much money is owed to, you know, for with no income coming in. But,
yeah,
you know, there's a case to be made. But, you know, in practical terms, it just feels really unlikely to me.
I don't think that's an especially in the NBA where basically by collective bargaining, the owners and players are essentially 50-50 partners on revenue coming in. Mm-hmm. Like, I think in another sport where kind of contracts are untethered from like direct business realities, maybe that's an argument. But like, the motivating factor of the CBA is like the rising and lowering tide lifts and drops all boats. And so mm-hmm. if there's, you know, there's no money coming in, there's no money coming in. And that's again, the NBA is having to deal with this much more publicly, but
right.
So many businesses are having to deal with this. And it's not fun choices being forced on anybody, but there are choices that as kind of adults living in the world we live in now, we have to approach and make as best as we can.
Right. It's a calculated risk by both sides. They both consented to that. As Dave pointed out, there wasn't going to be repercussions if you weren't comfortable for that. So to me, it makes sense. Like I feel confident that the league and Disney are going to do everything that they can to try to make this as safe as possible.
Right.
But there's the understanding that this is in fact going to be a risk. Now, what I do want to get your thoughts on is the Delete 8 bubble situation going on potentially in Chicago. Because when I heard that, I got very excited because I just desperately want to see the Cavs. But my real preference after giving it like more than a minute's thought is just mini camps, like lift the restrictions, let these teams have basically an early training camp, let them get some reps in if they want to do that. I don't really see the whole need for these guys to actually go out and play games against other teams.
Well, the reporting would suggest that that's what the teams actually want.
Right.
You know, Anthony Slater has talked about that with the Warriors. They want a mini camp. I don't see why teams wouldn't be able to arrange a mini camp of some sort. You know, they were already training in the facility. Certainly they could do an at-home quarantine. I mean, you know, it's a lot of personal responsibility involved in this, but they have the money for the testing. I mean, you know, I'm just not as worried about the teams kind of handling that on their own, whereas creating this other bubble, now you're adding a whole nother thing that could potentially fail. Back to the original, to the Orlando bubble, the one problem that Seth and I have had this whole time was that every team that was extra, meaning every team beyond the 16, every time you add a body,
amplifies the risk.
Exactly. And so, you know, the statistical likelihood of coming back from a three-game deficit to make the playoffs after 65 games is so low, it made no sense. Except when you start thinking about the money aspect of it, and
the play-in thing that they threw in the play-in thing, so that it was, because otherwise the playoff races are all basically over as soon as we get in if there isn't kind of the play-in catch-up rule.
Right. No. It seems unnecessary. Like, I kind of get it, but it is kind of an uncomfortable reality that it is adding risk to the equation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Doing anything is risky.
Right.
I just think here's a question, because I'm as the perpetually uneducated person in the group at this point, cause I don't pay enough attention anymore. Mm-hmm. And I can't even pull the dad card cause Seth has a kid as far as I remember, but God damn it. But, like, there is some, like, broadcast incentive for these Delete A teams to run this mini league, right?
funny. We talked about this yesterday with Larry Kuhn. It's and this was just like a private conversation we were having, but we could spill it here.
Yeah, there you go. Sorry, Larry.
No, but we talked about that, and Seth made a great point. It would be very easy for these teams like the Warriors to say, hey, if we hit our 70 games, we get all this cash. I mean, Seth, what did you say the response was going to be?
The regional sports network who is writing the check is like, wait, what now? You said 70 NBA games, not whatever this is.
Because right. Steph Curry and Klay Thompson are not going to be out there putting buckets on the Bulls. I'm sorry.
And it's going to be after the draft lottery as well. It's not like these games count for anything. So it's
If the games counting mattered financially, then the Fox Sports Ohio owes the Cavs nothing.
Well, see, that does set a weird precedent, though. What if they did come back and the RSN said that? Hey, you know, you guys are running a G League roster.
Oh, man. That would be very interesting. If you have to be this competitive to get your TV money.
Kevin has to come.
I think that actual NBA games probably are good enough. I do think that in the standpoint of, you know, putting my former lawyer hat on, I think that it's at least a colorable argument that if you trot, Alan Smalagich out there, the marquee matchup is hit against him against Chetty Osman.
Yeah.
What? That's a summer league game, and we're not paying you X dollars a game essentially for summer league. We're paying you for NBA basketball, and this isn't that.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dave just scared hell out of me with the hypothetical that this could be applied to regular season games, because the last thing that the Cavs need is more reasons for Dan Gilbert to make short-sighted win-now moves. That's not something that this organization needs.
I don't even think he could make a win-now move, though. Like, what win-now move is available? We talked about this. They have an awful cap sheet, and Kevin Porter Jr. is their best shot on the roster at a guy that, you know, maybe what does he top out at best case scenario? Second MVP? Best player on a good team.
Yeah.
Okay. Pump the brake. I love him.
Jimmy Butler.
I'm down.
I mean, listen, if he turns
we're talking Jimmy floor, Butler, right?
Yeah.
We're talking floor.
Floor, Michael Jordan.
Right.
Right.
Well,
right,
of course. You know.
The actor.
So one thing I do appreciate with your breakdown that you guys did. There's been quite a few that we've already kind of seen this quote unquote off season or whatever you want to call this hiatus. Most of them haven't even mentioned Kevin Porter Jr. Like Tom Ziller, who both Carter and I love, he's been very kind to us on the podcast and whatnot. He kind of lumped him in with Chetty Osman and Larry Nance Jr. as guys that are kind of in the rotation. And Seth even managed to mention Dylan Windler, who of course is a rich man's Duncan Robinson. So it was nice to see.
Or he doesn't exist.
Yeah. He may not exist. Like that was actually very nice to see him mentioned, because now I know that it's not a Fight Club situation where I'm just imagining this guy. But I definitely agree with the assessment that both of you guys have, that KPJ does kind of have the highest upside on the team. If for no other reason than kind of his size and ability to get it done on both ends of the floor.
Yeah, that, and also just there's more kind of blanks on his kind of grade sheet, just because he had a very partial season in college for a year and kind of did not get consistent playing time until a little bit later in this abbreviated season. So there's is that potential or is that just more unknowns? It's a little bit of both, but I mean, he was a top 10 type talent who fell in the draft for, kind of those injury and off court concerns. Mm-hmm. But it's still like the talent was, I scouted him, and like the talent is, like jumps off the screen. You're like going through a film set watching guys who might be there kind of in the late 20s or 30s and a bunch of guys who not this guy, whoa, what's that, who's that guy? He just the popped in that way. And so there, is there something there? Yes. Will he deliver on it?
That, yeah, that's,
I mean, probably not, but you say probably not for everybody. So,
yeah, I don't think that's an insult to say probably not. And like the stuff that you do see from him, I thought he would be a bit more of an eyesore to watch in his rookie year, even if he had some signs as a shot creator. You know, I thought we'd get a lot more, for lack of a better term, bullshit. Mm-hmm. Just him taking bad shots. And yeah, there was some of that. And there was some ball stopping, but there was a decent amount of decent passing. And the finishing at the rim was stunningly good compared to what I would expect, especially since it's not like he's a big frame dude. He's still pretty skinny.
I mean, he's 6'4", though. You know, he's not giving up a ton of size. It's not like, you know.
Hey, Tristan, he's playing 6'7" now. We're fully in on the height watch with KPJ.
If he's 6'9" next week, I'll know something's up. I saw that guy. All right, so I saw Kevin Porter. He was a scrimmage invitee to Hoop Summit, after his senior year of high school before he went to USC. And he was out there giving those dudes buckets. The guys who were actually invited to Hoop Summit, like you could see that he had a chip on his shoulder about the fact that he wasn't in the actual game. He was out there playing with Steve Blake. Seth, you've been to Hoop Summit, right? You know what I'm talking about. He was playing with the Portland Generals. And, I mean, he was by far the best player on the court, most confident, creating his own shot. And that's what we got to see when he had the opportunity to do it. Now, do I also love him because he's a lefty? Yeah.
Sure.
Sure. I'm a sucker for a left-handed basketball player. But the thing is, you can see he's got shake off the dribble. He's got fine. His size is fine. Like, you're not giving up size if he's playing the two.
And he played a lot of three this year because of how guard heavy the Cavs were.
Yeah, and finding a three in the NBA is really tough. I mean, and the Cavs have nothing. So, you know, that's going to happen some of these bad teams. But the thing is, like, the offensive side of the ball, the question marks on him are the same question marks you would have for most guys that are rookies. Can he create for other people? Is he going to be, you know, the rising tide? Is he going to, you know, elevate the rest of the team? Is he going to be able to, when he breaks down the defense, find the next guy or even see the guy after that? You know, those are the things that we need to see more of. And this is going to be, you know, we talked about this, taking a development approach and just leaning hard into that. But you've got this, the glut there with three guys that are almost playing the same position, two of whom are just, you know, tiny in comparison to the other guys on the wing. And I just don't know what they're going to do. I posited the idea that Sexton's really a six man. I don't think they're going to do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, he closed the season too well for that, you know, right. And in concert with that, Garland was too mediocre and didn't show enough. So it's like, you know, I don't think that the fit of a Sexton Porter backcourt feels very good. I mean, in your brain, you kind of say Garland Porter or Garland Sexton kind of is the way you got to go.
And statistically, Porter and Sexton together was a nightmare.
Neither pass and
yeah, it was awful.
Yeah,
yeah. So yeah. I don't know what the solution is. Seth, if you had to kind of pick who your starting backcourt was next year, where do you think you go?
I'd probably go.
It's not an easy choice.
Yeah, it's not an easy choice. Like, I would want to give Garland a full look.
Yeah.
But he was just so unimpressive this year that it's hard to want to commit to that. I think I start that way and am ready to move on quickly.
Yeah.
Part of it with Garland is, you know, the ACL is typically like a 2-year injury. So the first year back is, I mean, you're playing, but you're not all the way back. And then so this coming year, maybe, you know, like whatever the peak physical version of him looks like, we start to see that next year. And maybe that has a little bit more off the bounce and some of those other things that that will be necessary.
Well, one of the interesting things, so looking at last year, and actually Dave was one of the people that helped kind of talk me off the ledge last year when it came to Sexton, because I was not a fan of the pick and I was pretty critical of him early on. And what we got to see after the All-Star break kind of made it a little more encouraging. There were some reasons to – the high watermarks were there of, okay, maybe this guy could be fun to watch at some point. The Cavs obviously didn't get that. They didn't really get to try out the Andre Drummond rental here after the deadline. But one advantage that I think is going to be really interesting is even if they can have, like, let's say a September mini camp, let's say it's not a second bubble. The nice thing is they get to see how Garland and Kevin Porter Jr. look after essentially a full off season. And that comes before the draft. And especially when it's a guard heavy draft, getting to see what those guys look like after an off season is different than, okay, do we take LaMelo Ball in June? Or it's a totally different equation. And that's, I mean, if you're looking for bright sides, which is typically the way that I like to lean, the fact that they get to make an educated decision there and they get to find out if Garland actually looks like the player they thought they were drafting is really a huge plus.
I think they've got to just take the best player available no matter what. None of these guys look like franchise cornerstones. And I'm not saying that LaMelo is, but I think he's closer to that than Sexton, Garland, or Porter. Porter being the guy out of those three that I have the most confidence in getting to something close to that. Mm-hmm. You know, Garland's numbers really, like, to have him as a lead initiator, I think really would stunt your offense based on this season. Granted, I want to see what it looks like when he's totally healthy and we can get rid of the excuses that we have internally. I don't know.
Running an NBA offense also.
Right. Yeah. Running a real NBA offense would be nice. But like, he doesn't get to the free throw line at all.
Yeah.
His usage is pretty high. He's essentially like the players that he lines up with statistically look a lot like Klay Thompson.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was passive. He was right. Very, very passive. And that was something he even spoke to. Yeah.
And he doesn't defend like Klay.
Yeah.
I think that's pretty fair to say.
Right?
and he's not and I'm not saying he won't be, but he's not the shooter that Klay is currently. He's also not 6'7", he's 6'1". Mm-hmm. So he's going to be at a disadvantage if he's not a lead initiator from a size perspective. And I don't know. I think if you've got the number one pick, man, you take the player that you think is the best, even if that's, you know, a guy that's going to boot these other guys out of the rotation.
Yeah, but the problem is this draft doesn't, you know, it's not like there is a Ja Morant-esque guy in this draft that makes you feel confident. Like, I mean, there's a real chance that any of these guards will have just as terrible of a season as Garland had, right? Like, I don't look at any of these guards and say, oh, well, you know, at least his floor is much higher than Garland's last year. I think it could be pretty ugly no matter who they take.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing, like, to me, and I want to get both of your thoughts on this, like, to me, the top five guys in this draft, I would say, seem like they're in a very similar tier. So when you run into a situation like that, doesn't at some point your ability to develop a guy, like your confidence that you can provide a situation where they're not going to be clashing with existing players, doesn't your ability to get that player to a ceiling have to come into the consideration?
I think it's both the new player bringing in and also unless you're just giving up on the player you have. I'm a strong advocate for BPA drafting. But you're also, if you are freezing someone out and there are players of maybe different positional or skill set strengths that you have rated similarly, I might lean towards giving yourself the most upside of, well, if we hit on all these guys, then we'll have something. Mm-hmm. And really, if you doubled up on another kind of 1.5, or tripled up, I guess, in another 1.5. Like you're basically building in a loss on one of the either the guy you draft and one of Sexton and Garland, maybe two of them.
Yeah,
which is, you know, statistically it's likely that they're not all going to hit, but you take away even that top end chance of everything working out because there's just no way that you can that all three can hit just mm-hmm. by virtue of playing time and there's not enough minutes, there's not enough ball for that to maximize all those.
Although I mean LaMelo, if he's 6'7", why can't you play him with those guys? I don't see any reason why, like, have him guard the wing. They're all gonna defend about the same anyway. It's not gonna be good, right? This is gonna be, I mean, probably
if LaMelo played defense like his brother, I would feel a little bit better like that
with sure that. but I mean, I just don't think, you know, let's not box these people into positions. here.
That's fair. Right? Yeah. I mean, there's precedent of that too. And especially when both of them kind of project, Garland and Sexton kind of project as combo guards right now, having a lead initiator wouldn't be the worst thing in the world. It's just frustrating that there's no safe bets there. But you know what? If you are looking for some good betting action, sports are coming back, and so are your chances to bet on your favorite teams and events with our sponsor, BetOnline. There's no better place to start betting with our exclusive partner, BetOnline. You can get in on all the action for this week's UFC fight or check out the odds for NASCAR, Formula One, and the Premier League. Can't wait for your favorite team to come back? BetOnline has futures odds, including win totals, division winners, and even league champions. Or check out daily simulations of Madden and 2K to watch and wager on. Visit betonline.ag and use promo code BLUEWIRE to receive your new welcome bonus. That's promo code BLUEWIRE. BetOnline, your online wagering experts.
So before we talk about the Cavs, I'm really going to have to eat crow. I don't know if you guys knew this, but BetOnline's copy for several months included a promo for that you could bet on the Nathan's hot dog eating contest. Every time we read the copy, I would shit on them because I didn't think there was any chance they would do the hot dog eating contest. Apparently, it's bulletproof, baby. And so is Joey Chestnut. So it happened. I caught an L. I've been catching a lot of L's lately on my very strong takes. First, I said JR would never play in the NBA 3 years ago, and suddenly I'm about to lose this one. It was a year ago. Point is, if I say something aggressively, I was wrong. So just know, just do the opposite.
Mm-hmm. How did they do the hot dog eating contest?
They had them still
meet up.
In a very
gross manner.
With just no background noise to cover up all those the
gulps.
The process. And Joey Chestnut set another record.
Have you ever seen the sports science on that? It is horrifying. They had like a clear stomach with all the hot dogs and water going in.
Nope,
yeah, you don't want it.
Nope.
Yeah, I do know that those guys will eat like entire heads of lettuce, like to expand their stomachs.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. As I've said
that's
it before.
Like training.
I've said it before, but one of the great Dimitri Martin lines. An eating contest is just the beginning of a shitting contest. Congrats, you won, but in part two, everybody loses.
Oh, man, July 5th has to just be the worst day on the planet.
Apparently, while I was listening to a different podcast where they're talking about it, apparently he goes out and parties afterward. Joey Chestnut does. And I'm like, bro, lay me up in a hospital bed.
Well, I maybe that's to like kind of induce vomiting. Like that might be.
Oh, that's an interesting thought.
Could there's no way he doesn't have like a pit stop or two before he goes out.
I wish to be excluded from this narrative.
God, could you imagine? Sorry, one more Seth.
Maybe he has a full pit crew. Maybe he has a full pit crew pumping his stomach out.
Could you imagine being a bar owner and Joey Chestnut walks into your restroom the night of the hot dog eating? Please be peeing.
It'd be like the Larry David opening up a coffee shop without a toilet, just urinals. No defecating on the premises.
You got to think it's like a 50-50 though, because they're dipping it in water. Like it's not like he's not taking in a lot of water.
That's a good point.
It's so gross.
Is this what I get for all the Hamilton talk earlier?
This is exactly what you get. You get shit
talk
and
my
you'll
world,
like it.
Seth.
Speaking of defecating, let's talk a little bit about the Cavs coaching. Because things did not work out well with Bayline. It was a little frustrating.
I thought you were going to make an incontinence joke.
That would also work. He definitely would not be in either bubble if that was happening. But it was kind of funny to see three guards that kind of excelled in pick and roll situations, or at least that was their comfort zone. And then the Cavs basically ignoring the pick and roll because this might be a little bit of projecting on my behalf, but it does seem like some college coaches don't like isolation, pick and roll, kind of that easy stuff. They want to show off that they're a little bit of a genius, and the Cavs had a massive learning curve. Dave, I want to get your thoughts, though, on J.B. Bickerstaff, because the returns were not great in Memphis. He was kind of coaching for his job and leaned very heavily on the vets. Do you have some confidence that he can continue to improve as a coach, or that he might be a guy that is good as a transitional coach for the young Cavs?
Yeah, well, anytime a guy sticks around like he does, you know, he's at least got something, whether that's personality, likability. I mean, that stuff does kind of matter, especially in these situations. The most important thing to me, and Seth, you know, has worked for a team, so I'm sure he can speak to this even more intelligently, but like, you need organizational alignment in a rebuilding situation. And certainly a part of that is accepting your own fate and knowing that by the time they get good, you probably aren't going to be there. But he also got a longer term deal than anybody thought he would get. I thought he was just going to be the interim. They'd find another coach. And they locked him up until 2024. So, you know, I think the job ahead of him is going to be to use the experience that he's got from being in multiple locker rooms, teach the guys how to be in the league, how to play, set up an offense that is simple, straightforward, but actually, you know, utilizes NBA skills, meaning run high pick and roll, right? Run some motion, run some triangle, maybe, you know, like do some things that these guys are going to have to experience in their career so you can find out what they can do. That's going to be the key for him. You were right. It's very much like his Memphis stint was weird because he leaned so much on the veterans, and his offense was just very old school, very old school.
Yeah.
He's got to show these guys how to play in the NBA of 2020, 2021, not, you know, 2008. So if he can show that he can do that, I think, hey, great. Because clearly he's liked. Otherwise, he wouldn't have a job. You don't bounce around. I mean, it's not like he's bounced around because he keeps getting fired. He keeps taking over as the head coach, and then they move on. It's, you know, it's kind of a unique situation. He's got kind of the king of interim coaches.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, I don't know. I just feel like ultimately, like, they did need to commit one way or the other. I mean, the broken record that we talk about all the time on this podcast is that there's just no stability in that organization. And like, this is the way you do it, if you're going to do it, is you kind of commit to a guy. And, you know, I think the counter here is, of course, that Dan Gilbert doesn't mind paying 14 to 16 coaches at once in his past as an owner. But I do think the guy seems to have the locker room in his corner, which helps. And it didn't seem, I know he didn't have a long run post Beilein being fired, but it did feel like it wasn't just the dead coach bounce. Sorry, probably inappropriate. But like, you know, like I got the impression that he was, you know, like it wasn't like he was just the good guy and Beilein was the bad guy. After he took over, it still seemed like the players really believed in him and thought highly of him. And, you know, he did do some stuff that was just like, that I found encouraging. You know, they traded for Drummond and he didn't feel like he had to play Drummond 35 minutes a game to prove that the move was justified. He played the guy who was playing better, whether it was him or Tristan. And he even broke out some wonky lineups that that actually worked, where they had Larry Nance playing the three with Tristan and or it was Nance, Love, yeah, and Nance Drummond.
Is, yeah.
And those lineups were working. I think they actually got a shout out in a low 10 things I liked column. So he's had a little bit more willingness to experiment while also not feeling too bound by any dogma. So I don't know. I didn't mind my short stint with him, but I think we're gonna, I just hope the Cavs don't find out 20 games in the next season that, oh yeah, oh wait, this isn't the guy either.
So as I see it, he's got sort of two jobs right now. One is player development, and that's not so much him directly as him empowering his staff and, you know, setting up good regimens to allow these young players to improve their skills. And step two is a little bit what Dave said, is providing a clean environment for the front office to make decisions on these guys. One of the worst things about this past year was it was a horrific evaluation environment for Colin Sexton. Garland maybe was always going to be a kind of a lost year for the injuries, but you know, they're coming up to not very long until they have to start making decisions on these guys, and getting as much information as possible about, okay, what do we like, where do we really think Colin Sexton's reasonable ceiling is? Is he a guy we want to commit 4 years to, whatever the money is? Figuring that out is immensely valuable. It is far more valuable than grinding out an extra win or two will be next season.
Mm-hmm. So, and that's, I think that goes to what Dave is talking about organizational alignment, is being, is him having the faith that, that he's going to stick around long enough that if the front office says, all right, here's something we kind of want to take a look at, whether it's our, the video crew or the scouts or the analytics group, we saw this thing. We want to give this about a 5-game look where this combination, or we try this just to see what it looks like. Give us some data to go with, basically. Is he going to work with that, or is he going to, well, these idiots are just trying to make me look bad, make me get fired.
Yeah.
if my guess is for a guy who's kind of been a survivor, he's going to go along a little bit, and being able to do that effectively, I think will make him, for what the Cavs need, make him successful.
Mm-hmm. Well, also, I would guess he's going to have a Brett Brown opportunity. If they feel like he's done the job that they've asked of him and done it adequately, I don't see any reason why they wouldn't try to keep him around. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I mean, just well, knowing Kenny the Atkinson. NBA. Well,
that guy's already gone.
Don't sign KD. But if you look at, like, I mean, you know, we're going to be writing about the Timberwolves this week. Ryan Saunders kind of has a similar thing where, all right, he seems like a job that's a little bit too big for his experience. But when you look at what they did on the court, it's pretty clear that he was enacting the game plan that the front office, you know, wanted. And so that's going to afford him extra time. You know, whether we like it or not, it doesn't matter, but that's just the truth. And so the more hand in hand that coaches in these rebuilding situations do work with the front office, first of all, you're going to ingratiate yourself. I mean, it, just human nature, but also everybody's pulling one rope. It's the only way forward. You know, when you have these coaches coaching for their job and you know, just punting on the future to go, you know, 22-60 instead of, you know, only winning 15 games, like, who cares? It does you no good.
Especially in the Cavs organization, right. You can get fired as coach of a one seed.
I mean, So I think that going forward, I don't see any reason why he couldn't get another contract after this, but, you know, we'll see how it goes. I mean, again, being well-liked matters, especially with the young guys, man. He can clearly relate to them in a way that the previous coach could not.
That is true. And the other nice thing, too, is he does have a connection and has already worked with the assistant coaches that are on the staff, which is big, because I do like the staff that they put together. Mike Garrity's done a really good job. Lindsey Gottlieb has had a good connection with Kevin Porter Jr. and Sexton. J.J. Outlaw's done good work. You've heard praise from all those coaches. And player development is really the most important thing. So I think that's a really good observation, though, about just execute whatever the front office's vision is for what this roster will be. And then you'll have your proof of concept on whether or not you need to completely abandon this, or if it's something that you can build off of.
And if they decide to, and if for some reason they decide to move on, at least, you know, he secured the bag up front. So,
that's right.
You know, it's
which is every coach, just get term. If you're that's negotiating right. with the Cavs, just get term on your deal. You will be made whole. Don't you worry.
The same, man. The checks cash the same. Mm-hmm. It's dream jobs in life are, well, we're backup quarterback for the Patriots. We'll see now. Knicks head coach and Cavs head coach.
Well, I guess Bayline actually might be the only one that didn't get his full contract, because he gave up the rest of the money to walk away. Which,
well, I do think he has an ornamental role in the organization. Oh, I think his title is chief of going away.
Wow. Well, I guess the other part of this equation is Kobe Altman, though, right? Like, you guys both kind of agreed that the Cavs should not be in a position where they're giving up assets to move on from Kevin Love, because they're in asset acquisition mode. It's just not the best decision-making. How Kobe handles both Kevin Love and Drummond factor into his legacy? Because I feel like that's going to be one of the most important things. Like, do they view Drummond as someone that they're going to extend and is part of the future? Or do they see him as a very large expiring going into a great free agency class and try to use that as some sort of trade chip to get more assets?
I think they have to, right? Like, they're in full asset collection mode, right? Mm-hmm. So they need to be shopping both of those guys. And I'm with you. I think that we're going to be able to see a lot about what Kobe has picked up in the last few years with the way he treats that Kevin Love contract. We talked about it in the piece. I propose just eating it. If you, teams aren't offering you something for it, just eat it. That money doesn't mean anything to you. You're not going to spend it on a free agent, most likely. Mm-hmm. Sorry. So to give up anything that's down the line just makes absolutely no sense for this team. Now, you know, there's room for negotiation. It doesn't mean you don't include a pick with Kevin Love if you're getting something worthwhile back. But I think that we might be surprised what the market for Kevin Love looks like after this, you know, once we get to the offseason, because it's only 2 years left on the deal. Or no, sorry, 3 years left on the deal. Yeah. But he can shoot. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we saw what Ryan Anderson made in Houston. I think I'd trust Kevin Love to do a little bit more than Ryan Anderson did.
I'm really hoping the Nets strike out on options one and two, and you get the pressure from Kyrie and KD to trade for him, because that could potentially be a situation that would work out. But that's also in my wildest dreams here.
I do feel like the Kevin Love thing, the give up a pick, is almost like, I don't know, maybe this is a little too, you know, conspiratorial in nature, but like I almost feel like it's like wishful thinking from people who are like a little hungry for actions, he's going to go somewhere cool because no one's going to give up anything of value for him. So they'll have to give up a pick to a contender to get him there. Like,
it's like the Tristan Thompson buyout.
I don't know. It just feels like a little like it feels like wishful thinking to me. The idea that you're going to get something for taking him on from other fans who don't understand that he's still pretty good, but also still kind of want him.
I think that given the size of the contract, I don't think one pick is enough, to be honest.
Well, then absolutely.
Again, well, then they should just keep
it. I'm just, you know what?
It might be a J.R. Smith situation where, you know what, stay home if you don't want to play. Maybe they're hoping that as the young guys become a little more competent, it becomes less frustrating for him and he can at least get by playing with this team.
I think that, you know, my point is just that the money just doesn't mean anything for Cleveland because they're not going to spend it on a big time free agent. Having a guy like Kevin Love around for the next 3 years is not awful. I mean, it's not like you're going to make the team too good. I mean, we've seen that. You're not going to make them so good that you're going to have an awful lottery pick. And, you know, the guy knows how to play basketball and it's worthwhile to have good NBA players with your young guys. So, you know, it's not, they have to move him or else. They could just hang on to him for the next 3 years. Maybe he loves it in Cleveland. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. I mean, honestly, if some of the worries are obvious, you know, not to be like body language doctor guy, but it seemed quite clear that, he and Colin Sexton weren't on the best of terms on the floor.
That's a coach's job.
Yes. Right? But at the same time, if that is the kind of thing that is just there, then, you know, all of the things you just said about, you know, his contract and them not really being a free agent market for the next couple of years, all of that kind of holds true, just telling him to go home, mm-hmm. you know, and, you know, almost like under no circumstances would I advocate stretching him because you don't want to put that money out into the future. But if it's dead money and he's actually detrimental, and this is, you know, purely speculative on my part. But we've seen it happen before where mm-hmm. a veteran on a big contract is an unhealthy presence on a team. And I think that, you know, it's probably tough to sell to ownership, but the best thing might just be,
hey,
you know, send it away. You know what?
Here's the thing, though.
The timing issue for him is that this, like, he's going to be, 34 at the end of this contract?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
That's a big deal.
Yeah.
It's the rest of his like late prime, you know, depending on how he ages, right? And I do, like, from a human being perspective, it would be tough on him. So I don't know if that he would agree to just go, you know, softly into the night.
Yeah, I mean,
we have one more year of play for your freedom with Kevin Love, where he understands, hey, I have to be a good soldier. I have to play hard. And hopefully that's going to help kind of resuscitate his trade value to some extent to the point where they can at least not have to give up an asset.
It's wild to see a situation where zero parties have any leverage because everyone's miserable, you know? But this is kind of where we're at, where it's like, Love has no incentive to stay home. Like, he's 31. What is he going to do? Spend the next 3 years on his couch? So that doesn't work. He doesn't want to take a big buyout either. And I'm sure it'd have to be a pretty good one to make it worth the Cavs' while. So as far as it stands right now, it feels like, In the long term, his best route to basketball happiness is become a really, really good mentor, become a really, really good team guy, and try to get these guys to the point of competence where he, again, you can kind of play for your freedom a little bit. And, you know, maybe the team gets decent along the way. I mean, you know, there are spots where teams get good out of nowhere.
Look at Oklahoma City this year. Look at what Chris Paul did. Coming into the season, it was all, well, they have to move Chris Paul. Chris Paul's not going to be happy in Oklahoma City. They're going to be awful, blah, 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 blah. Well, Chris Paul's a really good basketball player, turns out.
Yeah.
He makes a lot of money, but he's still a really good basketball player. And he played his ass off. And, you know, that's another thing, man, is like you can actually do a lot for yourself just by being a good citizen and playing your ass off as a
be happier too.
In a bad situation. Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. Why not?
More fun.
Do it.
I'm so glad you didn't say shut up and dribble.
No, but maybe the Knicks – I mean, listen, maybe the Knicks see Kevin Love next year putting up, you know, 24 and 13 or something, and they're like, you know, wouldn't look too bad next to Mitchell Robinson.
Yeah, I don't know, man. It just makes the most sense for him to get to this level of, you know, it's okay. And, you know, like, I mean, it didn't end up working out, but, you know, you look at Memphis this year, you know, Andre Iguodala wouldn't play with that team. And it was like, well, you know, he got out, but like, it always struck me as a little weird that he was willing to sit out the year, even once he realized that team was really, really good or, you know, really, really overperforming expectations to the point where they're a playoff team in the West. You know, so like things happen quickly in the NBA, you know, rebuilds last forever until they don't.
Yeah. In Iggy's defense on not coming back once they showed they were good, that would have been a way worse look.
No, it wouldn't have.
I think
you got to double down.
You
got to just say, I'm not playing here. We all would have said he would have been like KD joining Steph Curry. Like, we would have treated him the same way.
No, forget all of the players were like, just, bro, we get it.
On the just bandwagon.
No,
maybe they go with it, but. But
all
I,
the
I
players
so.
Clearly were hurt that he still wouldn't come back after they had proven that they were worthwhile.
I remember the young Memphis guys and Iguodala beef was actually one that I was interested in.
My feelings would be hurt.
It gave him a chip. I like that. I'd like to see young players get a little insulted.
Yeah, it was super fun.
Yeah, but no, we would have roasted Iggy if he did that.
I would have said, yep, that makes sense. Good for you. Thanks for getting with the program.
Wait, hey, Seth, what were you about to say about Kevin Love? Sorry to like take over hosting.
No, please do.
He's about to get me on something.
I wanted to there was a difference of opinion about how good Oklahoma City would be preseason and
I thought they would be.
I thought they'd be
the
good
eighth seed if they kept Chris Paul, but I didn't expect him to keep Chris Paul.
Yeah. Anyway, the other, just to finish up on Kevin Love, though, I think maybe the best kind of amicable divorce is he plays well for about a year and a half to the point where a playoff team lets it be known that there's a spot for him. And then at that point, there's maybe some wiggle room for a buyout. That's if the needle is going to be thread.
Yeah.
That's kind of where it is.
Let me just say, I'm happy if he finishes this contract out in Cleveland. I like having him on the team. I still think when he's engaged and having his and the guards are actually getting him the fucking ball, which you know they do sometimes.
That actually wraps into
it's fun. Pretty fun still.
That ties into something I was going to say before we wrap up. Both of you have been incredibly generous with your time. Really, really appreciate it.
I love how you talk to us like we're like diplomats or something.
No. First of all, I respect both of your opinions and your time. You know what?
I respect Seth's time.
That's true. I respect yours a little less, Dave.
Yeah, good. Okay, good.
You've come on too many times. Seth's been like a one-timer.
This is true. This is very true.
It's at least my second time on the show.
Yeah, this is your second time. I'm 99% sure.
Does this only count as half an appearance?
That's a good
question. Half of your body is showing up with the aurora borealis behind you. So
that's true.
So we're losing more of you by the second. Boys, can't hide these shoulders.
Man, I had a segue and now it's all botched. Look at this.
It's their fault, not mine.
Anyways, so
it's nice to have the host.
One thing that I've mentioned before on the podcast is I can't really feel upset anytime somebody gives a not favorable evaluation for the Cavs. One, the situation is not great. And two, you can't really expect people to be invested in kind of the high water marks that someone like Sexton, Garland, or KPJ show throughout the season. Like they're going to put less stock in it than we will, because I'm invested. I want that to be the case. I want them to look good. What are the odds? How soon do you think this team could be bad but watchable? It is basically my question, because they're going to be bad for a little while, because anytime you give this much playmaking responsibility to young guys, you're going to suck. But do you see some sort of avenue that maybe even next season, if there's decent jumps from these guys, that this could be a somewhat watchable team?
Seth, I'll let you go first.
I feel like the Drummond being involved, it probably hurts the watchability a little bit. I think if one of the guards was a more dynamic pick and roll facilitator, that might do some interesting things with Drummond. But as it is, it's just there's a lot of gunk. That's, you know, it is going to be very, with him in the mix, it's going to be a very kludgy offense. And that's just, you know, how it's going to be.
I mean, that's what we saw with the immediate returns too. It was funny because the Cavs played better after the trade deadline and switching over to JB, but the numbers were basically all indicate that it was very bad with Drummond, and it was just Tristan playing a lot better and the guards playing better when it came to pick and roll. Dave, do you see any avenue for this team being kind of fun and watchable next season?
I'll continue my role as the optimist, and I'll say
thank you.
There are some signs that could lead in that direction, right? They get a full camp with Bickerstaff. Bickerstaff's getting a bunch of time to learn, you know, hey, this will work for us. Working with his assistants, I'm sure, during this entire thing, planning for next year, okay? This is all theoretical. So full camp, everyone buys in. Kevin Love, Andre Drummond, they're like, while we're here, we're here. We're fully committed. Let's go. Space the floor. Push the ball. Like, take advantage of some of your quickness with Sexton, who's really fast. He's actually a really good high school track athlete.
Kevin Porter Jr.
Yeah. Kevin Porter Jr., you know, with his off-the-dribble creation, Sexton can spot up around him. He's a good shooter. You know, figure out what you got in Garland. Whoever's in this draft, you know, find a way to work them in as much as you can. Again, getting buy-in, but not overplaying Love or Drummond, because you don't want to win too many games just because you've got some competent players.
Not worried about that, Dave.
Right. Yeah. But that could be fun. I'm of the opinion, if you are young and bad, you might as well play a fun style of basketball, which lends itself to letting these guys make mistakes. I mean, pushing the ball in transition, you're going to see that a lot. Guys looking to make the outlet pass. I mean, Kevin Love's fantastic at that. So take advantage of that. Use it. Teach these guys how to play in the NBA. So it could be fun. We'll see. I mean, it's very dependent on the style that they play, though.
Mm-hmm. And let's keep our fingers crossed that Kevin Porter Jr. is actually 6'6", 6'7", now, because that would make things.
I heard he was 6'9". Earlier on the podcast season. When I said it.
I'm pretty sure I said 6'7". I said Tristan says he's 6'7", but if we're going to drag him up to 6'9", I'm fine with that. I'll take 6'6".
I'm ready for Cavs muscle watch, okay?
Well, when Colin Sexton's pushing cars uphill on his IG Live every other day. So
how much is he eating? That's the important thing. I want to see him put on 10 pounds.
If I don't see him eating 10 chicken breasts a day, then I'm out.
He's going to eat full rotisserie chickens every single day.
No, we need ribeyes.
Oh, okay. I
like that. We need some real food. Like, he's got to, like, put on some weight. But, yeah, I think that this team, yeah, they could be fun, man. KPJ is already fun.
He is already fun.
I love to watch that guy. So, you know, just put the ball in his hands and let him cook. Go Trae Young with Kevin Porter Jr. and see what happens.
Hell yeah, I'm all for it. You know what?
Calm down, Dave.
Hopefully they show some growth this summer, and they can somewhat justify that kind of responsibility. That would be a nice first step, and we'll see where things go from there. I want to thank you guys very much for coming on. To all our listeners, make sure you're subscribing to the Back to Back podcast. Listen to Nerder She Wrote on the Back to Back feed on the Athletic Network. Dave, you put your finger up like you want to say something.
So I got a question.
Uh-oh.
I just need to know what Carter's favorite bird is.
I don't want to play this fucking game. Fuck you, Joe. Carter, get out of our comments.
Carter is such a poor sport when it comes to the bird thing. Our listeners will know.
We have a private Discord server for people who review our podcast, Dave, and there is a birding channel in there now.
Yeah.
Because there is enough. No, there's no, enough legitimate birders in the group that we needed a channel to contain the conversation.
Hey, listen, shit, you can't watch the Cavs.
No.
In today's microwave society, Cavs fans, we have refined tastes. We will do things like bird watching and enjoying nature. So how about that? As I said, guys, make sure that you subscribe to the Back to Back channel. Go read The Athletic. Is there still a promo going on for The Athletic right now?
Yeah, you can go to theathletic.com/back-to-back, and I do believe it's 30% off right now.
How about that? Go subscribe to The Athletic. Support what you guys got going on there. And if you want to support our podcast, you can do so by leaving a rating, leave a review, subscribe, unsubscribe, resubscribe, and help cook those books. If you want to be part of our weird Discord chat and talk about bird watching and all that good stuff, send a screenshot of that review to chasedownpod@gmail.com. We really do appreciate all the support from you guys. Make sure you're staying safe out there. Until next time, go Cavs.
This is Brandon Kelly, the host of Blue Wire's new podcast, Golden Goal.
Messi takes everybody on. Messi has got it!
From Lionel Messi to Marta to Pele, our show takes a deep dive into soccer superstars.
2-0 and he's... What a World Cup for Megan Rapinoe!
From Zlatan Ibrahimovic's brash confidence with the play to back it up, to Megan Rapinoe's heroic outspokenness and World Cup flair. Each episode examines a personality of the world's game. We'll dig into Maradona's Hand of God performance and subsequent downfall. The teenage trio at Dortmund that signaled the next generation of superstars. And that infamous headbutt that slung Zinedine Zidane from glory. Golden Goal. Soccer stars and the moments that made them. Premiering this summer on Blue Wire.